Welcome to the NTNU International Taiwan Study Center podcast. It's great to be back, and this time we're crossing pretty much the entire world, or at least definitely crossing the Pacific, and welcoming Professor James Lin from the University of Washington. James, thank you so much for being with us at this very different time for you. I think we were just figuring out it's about 15 or 16 hours difference. So great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Joshua. And yeah, it's the evening here, so I'm still going strong. We're not it's not the middle of the night or anything, so I've still got a few hours left in me.
Oh, that's great. Now, James, I wanted to start off with your new book this year, In the Global Vanguard, Agrarian Development and the Making of Modern Taiwan. I was wondering if you could explain a little bit of what inspired the research behind the book, and then why did you decide to turn it into a book?
Yeah, so this book was based on my PhD dissertation, which I wrote at UC Berkeley, and I finished my PhD about 8 years ago now. Time really flies. And I can tell you the story about how this became the subject of the dissertation. I'll go back really early. I'll go back to when I was doing my MA at Columbia, and I was looking to find something to write about for my MA thesis. And, you know, being based in New York, I thought I'd check out the local archives. And at that point, I knew that, you know, I had Chinese language fluency, and I wanted to write a topic about Chinese or Taiwanese history. And so I went to probably one of the closest archives near Columbia, which was the Ford Foundation Archives. And at that point, it was still in Midtown Manhattan. Those archives had not been moved to the Rockefeller Center yet. And I went to the basement. I made an appointment with the archivist. And I was just looking for files related to Taiwan, and I came across this one microfilm reel dealing with something called the Asian Vegetable Research and Development Center.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you know, like, I love food. And I think the reel was related to something like, it was rapini or broccoli rabe, or, you know, one of these vegetables in the broccoli family. And I found it so interesting that the document I was looking at was basically explaining how broccoli developed in the AVRDC, the Asian Vegetable Research Development Center, was purposely designed to increase vitamin nutritional intake in the 1970s in the Global South. And so they were advertising this and marketing it for specifically for African nations in this one document. And I thought, this is so interesting that, you know, there's this language of modernity, of nutrition, of global health, and this language of development that is going on between Taiwan and Africa. And so I just kind of traced that history back, where I looked into, you know, what was the history of the AVRDC. I went backward to the Joint Commission on Rural Reconstruction, which becomes the central actor in the dissertation. And then I go back even earlier to the Republican era in China, where many of the earliest commissioners of the JCRR first cut their teeth in rural reform and in agricultural science. And so the dissertation eventually came to be this kind of long history of agricultural developments culminating in the 1980s in Taiwan with the Asian Vegetable Research Development Center.
Sounds like an important history that we don't hear much about. So I'm glad that you decided to turn it into a book. What was the jump then from PhD dissertation into In the Global Vanguard, the actual book?
Yeah, so the dissertation was mostly focused thematically on a couple different things. It was mostly focused on the diplomatic history. So I looked at a lot of diplomatic documents, and you'll see this in like chapter 5, for example, if we talk about the Africa chapter, the diplomatic background to that is really important. And it was also focused on the political economy. So looking at the economics of development. As I began to revise it for a book, so this is part of the, you know, in the United States, when you get a tenure track position, you go up for tenure, you need to have a book published. And so it's typical to take the dissertation and to revise that into the book. As I began the process of revising is also when I began to teach more broadly beyond what my initial PhD training was on, which is on diplomatic history, international history, and political economy. And so I taught courses on, first of all, in Taiwan studies, modern Taiwan history. I taught courses on history of science and technology, history of environment, as well as more broadly kind of social history, history of gender, history of labor, and all of these kinds of other subfields began to make their way into the book. And so I began to expand it to think about, for example, chapter 7 is really heavy on history of science and technology. And I'm really influenced by science technology studies theories like Latour and like others who've written about STS. Chapter 2 on land reform was new in the book. And that is mostly because I'd been reading a lot on new histories of capitalism, how transformations of society unfolded in the 20th century as a result of expansions of capitalist systems. The other transformation that the dissertation underwent was one of kind of methods and sources. So the dissertation was really written based upon archival documents that I'd used, mostly from Taiwan, some from the United States. But as I was revising for the book, I'd received advice from a senior historian that, we really want to tell a history that's not just told from government perspectives, that you want to bring in history from below. And this is kind of difficult for a book on development. But what I did find was many of the agricultural technicians, they were retired and they were elderly, but I was able to find some of them. And so in the course of revising to the book, I began to do a lot of oral history interviews. I think I ended up nearly a dozen oral history interviews with these retired Taiwanese agricultural technicians who went to Vietnam, who went to Africa, who went to Latin America and the Middle East during the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I began to integrate their perspectives on the ground into the book.
And that, I guess, is fascinating that you've got them both sides, like you say, of the people on the ground who are involved in implementing the policies, as well as the official documents from above that are talking about the policies. That, I guess, adds a completely different perspective to the story that you're telling. Just before we get into the story itself, in your introduction, you're talking about a way in which development was used as a tool to build power in a lot of states around the world, actually, when there was something of a vacuum left from the trend of decolonization. I wonder if you could just explain a little bit about the development that you're talking about, because again, that's something that you bring up in the book.
Yeah, so the introduction is where I have that section, what is development? Because development can mean a number of different things. And so how I approach development is I approach this as a state project that is designed to make things better, kind of more generally. I think in your introduction, I have a little bit more specific about it. So it's about increasing social capacity, usually with the involvement of increasing economic growth as well. And so it's meant to be a broad definition because there are different things that I treat as development. So I look at things like implementation of public health, increase of nutritional and caloric standards, and then, of course, the more traditional kind of increase of agricultural productivity and increase of overall GDP growth, so growing the overall economy. And I say all of these are developments, and I try to do this because I want to study how all of these projects begin with kind of the state in the background attempting to shape society, to transform society into something that is modern, something that is better. And at the risk of making this into something so vacuous, it loses meaning. I try to situate something that has a specific project, but also something that can encompass all these different forms of development that I discuss. And so this is why in the book, I focus on things like land reform, on nutritional sufficiency, on what might be considered high modernist science. So, high yielding crop cultivars and chemical pesticides and fertilizers.
And I guess then bringing that into the story that you're telling a little bit, you're looking at how Taiwan, the ROC, the Republic of China, as they were putting themselves forward as then, was quite proactive in reaching out to what you could call the developing world, the global South, African, Latin American, Middle East and Southeast Asian nations, with this kind of, I guess in a little bit, is this Taiwan can help message that we've seen come around again, pandemic era and post-pandemic era. But what was behind that? What were the motivations that were behind this project?
Yeah, I would argue that it's you've drawn an important contemporary parallel. I would argue that the Taiwan Can Help campaign that arose out of COVID-19 and Taiwan's exclusion from the international system, really that has its roots in development, in agrarian development in particular, in the 1950s, 1960s. So in the book, I make the argument that in the post-war period, this is when we really begin to see the growing allure and growing power of modern science and technology, as well as of economic growth. So this is the period when all of these newly emerging nation states, especially in Africa, are beginning to come to power. And most of these are post-colonial societies where indigenous rulers are taking the reins of government and trying to rule their own people. At the same time, there are demands that are made of them, that they need to bring economic growth, they need to bring, you know, modern societal practices. And to do so, you need to have the economic capacity to do things like purchase fertilizer, to purchase seeds, to build out your economy requires an initial kind of economic capacity. And so how do you do that? How do you start this process? And so Taiwan at this time is experiencing its own political difficulties. So, you know, post-1949, the Kuomintang escapes from China, sets up a government exile in Taiwan, but it continues to claim that it is the legitimate ruler of all of China. And it kind of rules by facade. And so in the United Nations, it's kept the seat that it's the legitimate government of all of China, despite only ruling one province. And so this facade begins to develop cracks as all of these newly decolonized nations, especially the ones in Africa, are not really sympathetic to this Republic of China regime. And so they are sympathetic to the PRC, which is on the outside trying to get its representation in the United Nations.
Where would that sympathy come from, James? Is that something to do with lingering distrust of the Western colonial powers and therefore a kind of sympathy towards China who are seen on the outside? Or why would there be sympathy for the PRC but not for the ROC?
Yeah, I think that is part of the story. I think it depends on the particular country that we're looking at. Okay. So for some of them, the ones, especially like East African nations, like I think probably like Tanzania and these other countries that were more socialist leaning, ideologically probably had some sort of affinity with the Second World. So with socialist nations, they lean more towards the socialist direction in terms of their own domestic politics and in terms of their international politics, found solidarity with other socialist nations. So for some countries, I think that was the case. For some countries, they voted along what their former colonial rulers voted. And so Francophone West Africa, that was the case where they often followed what France did. And we have to keep in mind that even some Western countries were very quick to recognize the PRC. So it wasn't just, you know, non-Western countries that wanted to hold out and recognize the ROC. Actually, many Western countries realized that, you know, this Chiang Kai-shek was probably not going to take the mainland back. And so, you know, they accepted reality as it was. Really, it was the United States that had been exerting pressure for countries to kind of follow the ROC. And by the 1970s, that began to lose steam.
And then so in light of this, there's this development project from the ROC as a means partly to try to persuade to get these votes in the UN from these new nations.
Yeah, it's a bit of horse trading, a bit of, you know, I'll give you development assistance in exchange for your vote in the United Nations. And so that was the background for what was eventually called Operation Vanguard, which was this Taiwan Ministry of Foreign Affairs project to basically kind of stave off the PRC's international pressure campaign to sway these new African nations to support the PRC. And so the ROC utilized development as a means to kind of exchange favors with many of these decolonizing African nations.
And so pre-1971, where the ROC essentially gets kicked out of the UN, did it work? Were there any results of it? Like, did countries that they were giving assistance to vote for their cause in the UN?
Yeah, so I guess different definitions of success. Obviously, from the diplomatic perspective, it was not successful. You know, the ROC loses its seat in 1971. And so that kind of force was not held back by development. In terms of whether or not the development missions were a success, so maybe from the perspective of, did they improve society? Did they increase agricultural yields? Did they improve local economies? That's a bit of a more complicated question, which is why I tried to do the oral histories to kind of supplement that story. In development studies, there is a lot of critical kind of approaches to development. And so one of the more famous critical development scholars is James Ferguson, who wrote this book in the 1990s called The Anti-Politics Machine, where he argues that development always tries to portray itself as apolitical, as technical, as being able to overcome and transcend social and political constraints. And it's kind of a hypocritical position because it really isn't able to do that. Its development is fundamentally a political enterprise. It requires large-scale social, economic, political change. And so the Taiwanese missions, I think, even though they attempted to portray themselves as modern seeds, modern science can bring you development, in actuality, they faced many of the same obstacles that Western development projects faced as well. So, you know, Taiwanese missions were extremely limited. The largest missions might have only sent maybe just a bit over 100 technicians at their height, which is simply not enough, especially compared to the scale that Taiwan domestically experienced under the JCRR. Its budgets were limited. And, you know, it really couldn't change domestic social structures. And that's really what you need to have in order to have real developments like in Taiwan. Taiwan had an authoritarian government. It had massive amounts of foreign aid through the United States. It had all these factors that Taiwan could not reproduce in Africa. And so in that regard, its success was really limited. In some of the demonstration farms that Taiwanese technicians were at, you know, there's a scholar, Liu Xiaopeng, Philip Liu, who's done some interviews with some of these African farmers. And some of them have memories of the Taiwanese technicians and the Taiwanese demonstration farms. And some even have quite positive attitudes about it. But in terms of long-term change, it's really not there.
That's interesting. The way you say they faced many similar issues that Western development efforts also faced. Something that you bring out, though, that potentially could be slightly different is the way in which these projects, these missions, actually reflected back onto Taiwanese society and actually had quite an impact on building a Taiwanese identity, or at least contributing to the Taiwanese identity. When you bring up this point, it's like, okay, that's quite an interesting insight. Maybe you can elaborate on it a bit as well.
Yeah, so I argue that actually the longest term effects of development were not in the recipient nations, so not in Vietnam, not in Francophone West Africa, but rather in Taiwan itself. And this is looking at a lot of the media representations of Taiwanese international development missions. So at this time, you know, Taiwan is under martial law. The Kuomintang government rules by force, by terror, and it controls all of the media. You have to, if you're a newspaper, you have to have a media license to publish. If you're a newspaper and you're publishing things that are anti-government, chances are you're going to get a knock on your door from a government official telling you, stop doing that. And you're probably going to listen, because otherwise then the garrison command follows up and worse things come. So I looked at these media representations of development successes abroad, and I saw how these successes were utilized as a way to portray Taiwan, the ROC, as a modern vanguard nation. So a nation that is not only helping other nations in the world become more modern and helping them out of hunger and sometimes out of war in the case of Vietnam, but also reflecting that Taiwan is at the vanguard. It is a modern nation that others want to follow as a model. And so representing this back home is a way that the authoritarian Kuomintang government attempted to use a carrot to kind of complement the stick of martial law, that you can portray what your government is doing in Taiwan and abroad as a sign of its technical prowess, of its destiny, of its place as a great nation, as a modern nation, as a scientifically and economically wealthy nation. And this is something that became quite effective for the Kuomintang, that development became this important platform that it utilized to help consolidate its martial law rule at home.
And did that give a sense of legitimization then to the KMT?
I argue it does. And it comes at a time when that legitimacy was really being challenged. So in the book, I look at a lot of the elites that are in charge of agrarian development. And for the most part, they're all Weishennen. So people who had come with the KMT mostly in 1949. And for the Weishennen, you know, their bargain, as historian Dominic Young has shown us, is that support the KMT, and then one day the KMT will bring us back to the mainland. Yeah. By the 1960s, this kind of bargain begins to fall apart as many of the Weishennen elite begin to see that, you know, the possibility of going back home was increasingly dim as Taiwan's military was going nowhere and the PRC was just consolidating its power year after year. And so with the nuclear tests that the PRC was doing, I think that was the moment when many of the KMT elite saw this as kind of the point of no return. And development just happened to be taking off at that point. I argue that development really begins to replace the myth of return to the homeland as this way of binding together the Weishennen population. And then for the Benjamin, the carrot is really important that the Kuomintang is bringing to Taiwan economic growth, economic opportunities that previously they'd experienced in the Japanese, but with the Second World War, the economic situation in Taiwan was really bad. And so the 1960s, you begin to see a return to that, as well as this kind of new non-ethnically based kind of nationalism that's based on technical prowess, on scientific modernity that the Kuomintang then begins to portray in state-controlled media, newspapers, magazines, and that sort of thing.
That's fascinating. So then you're bringing up this shift from an ethnic nationalism into a more modernistic technological national identity that's getting pushed, that is, I guess, trying to bring people together, could you say? Bring people together, I guess, in support of the regime that is controlling them.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, the Han kind of chauvinist nationalism is still, it's still primary, of course. You know, textbooks in Taiwan are still saying that we are the inheritors of 5,000 years of Chinese civilization. That's not going away. But the idea of economic modernity, I think, really begins to supplement that by the 1960s. And of course, by the 1980s, it really becomes the major way of legitimizing KMT rule. And we like to argue that Han Kuo-yu, when he ran for the presidency, and he began to hearken back with this populist message of make Taiwan great again, like it was 1980s Kaohsiung, you know, that's really hearkening back to the era of the economic miracle and of development as the main platform the KMT used, which shows us that, you know, economic development in some ways has eclipsed the importance of Chinese nationalism as the main platform for the KMT.
When we look at the CCP's Belt and Road Initiative, is there a case for suggesting that they have learnt from Chiang Kai-shek's book of this development assistance for legitimization, for pushing of the idea of being a great power and having global status?
Yeah, we don't have the kind of archival evidence to say for sure. But I do think that development as a central kind of political legitimacy is a formula that has been used not just by Taiwan, but by countless authoritarian regimes around the world, by especially by the time that the PRC is undergoing, you know, reform and opening, which is when it really kind of drops the socialist project and replaces it with a capitalist kind of economic project. I think by that time, this is a model that has been South Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong. You know, these are places where this model has already been tested and proven effective. And so the PRC today is probably one of the best instances where you have this kind of authoritarian government that links economic growth to its core legitimacy. The BRI itself, I think that there's more going on in the BRI than I think actually in the Taiwanese agrarian missions, because there are both capitalist incentives in the BRI and there are also strategic incentives in the BRI. Sure. So it actually is a little bit more important than the development missions were for Taiwan. But I think in terms of the importance of economic legitimacy for the status of China in the international system, and historically the status of Taiwan in the international system, yeah, definitely there's a lot of similarities.
That's interesting. I guess if we're talking about the BRI, China's got so many more resources, so much more that they can put into it, that, like you say, it is actually bringing in a lot more of the geopolitical strategy than the agrarian missions that you're talking about in the book. Coming back to that idea of identity, though, something else that I was interested in was this idea that the development and the kind of achievement, the technological achievement, the agricultural achievement of Taiwan in being able to then take this success to other parts of the world, reflecting back and contributing to the sense of Taiwanese identity and that we've achieved something great and we can share it with the world. Do we see that again now with semiconductors, this sense of Taiwan has made this incredible achievement and it's something that the world needs and wants, and now, you know, these other countries are trying to attract Taiwanese technology firms, TSMC, to set up shop in their nations. How much similarity do we have here? I mean, Taiwan's not authoritarian anymore, obviously, but in terms of influencing the identity of the nation, can we draw parallels there, or is it slightly different?
Yeah, I think it's a very good observation. And, you know, sometimes when I give a talk about my research, I do exactly that, which is I start with an article about TSMC and about Taiwan, and then I use the exact same, so this is Time Magazine, I use the exact same magazine article, 1960s, very similar title, except instead of semiconductors, it's pineapples and canned mushrooms, which were the, you know, the main kind of entry point to Taiwan's agrarian development in the 1960s. So same magazine, just 60 years apart. So there is some kind of resonance that's, I think, going on in the present. Although I think you've pointed to an important difference, which is that in the 1960s, Taiwan is in the midst of the authoritarian martial law period. And in the 1960s, agrarian development, I think, is very purposefully curated into this narrative by government sources, by propaganda sources, by government officials, by scientists and technicians to become this kind of image, a facade, really, of what Taiwan, what the Republic of China is. Today, I think that there is also this narrative, and in some ways, it is kind of a facade, although I think the facade is partially fueled by the kind of economic moment where, you know, TSMC and NVIDIA have just wild stock valuations, representing the importance of their products for, you know, the current AI boom. We're at the height of this bubble, this craze around AI. And this is very particular to our moment. There's definitely a little bit of inflation around that. But I think it's really because of kind of economic market factors and that we're seeing this craze and this frenzy around this, as opposed to, you know, an authoritarian regime in the background purposefully crafting it as kind of propaganda narrative. So they're slightly different. I think this current moment is, as a result, it is a little bit kind of overblown in some ways, but it's also a little bit more superficial. It doesn't have that kind of nefarious authoritarian politics behind it.
Yeah, that's a clear distinction, and much better in this case for the people in Taiwan right now to feel proud of their semiconductor industry without having to have the authoritarian part to go with it. In terms of the research and the book, how do you see that feeding into the wider field of Taiwan studies at the moment?
Yeah, so I hope that I can make a couple interventions into the field. One is thinking about Taiwan's place in the world as an important part of understanding what it means to be Taiwanese. So Taiwan's status in the international system has traditionally been relegated to kind of IR, political science, you know, the things that someone like Lev Nachman, for example, if he were doing his research 40 years ago, you know, it would be about Taiwan, the international system. And these days, when we look at the political science field, I think that a lot of it is really focused on Taiwan as a democracy. So again, you know, Lev Nachman's doing studies of third parties. This is the research of like Karis Templeman's really interested in electoral politics, Nathan Bato, David Fell. And then in the history field, it's really a focus on domestic social history. So I'm thinking Evan Dolly is really concerned about identity in Japanese colonial and early KMT Tidong. Dominic Young is really concerned about Wai Shennan and the role that Wai Shennan play in Taiwanese history. So in some ways, this current turn that we're in has really focused on Taiwanese identity as kind of a domestic social factor. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we are in this decolonizing moment where the old scholarship was produced when Taiwan was still the Republic of China under KMT control. And now that we've moved on to democratic Taiwan, that the influence of looking at multi-ethnic Taiwan, Taiwanese identity is the new field that we're looking at. And I want to bring the international, the global back into the picture to understand that Taiwan's place in the world actually has an important effect on its domestic history, on domestic identity. So that's where I see as one big intervention. The other is bringing back in political economy to understanding how Taiwan unfolds. Because again, I think that we've seen a lot of focus on identity, on social circumstances. As someone who prioritizes political economy, I think that political economy is a large part of the picture that should be brought in. And then as well, science and technology studies. So thinking about how science and technology from a critical perspective, so not just the unfolding of science in this kind of Whiggish, progressive, modernist story, but from a really critical perspective, I think is also important. So I've tried to bring these different kinds of subfields to bear and hopefully have made a contribution to that.
Yeah, I would say you definitely have. And I think that's something that's brilliant about the field of Taiwan studies is that we have fantastic contributions like yours that bring in different angles, bring in different sides, whether it's of history, society, cultural study. The beauty of Taiwan studies is as it develops, we get this more and more rounded knowledge, more and more rounded perspectives. So yes, I would say your contribution is vital.
Thank you. I hope so.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, James. It's been a great conversation and I hope we can continue it. Perhaps before we end, do you want to just fill us in on what's coming up for you in the future?
Yeah. So I'm thinking about a couple different projects after this. Very briefly, the first one involves history of capitalism, which is something that I'd become really interested in when I wrote the Lenin-Form chapters in the book. And I'm looking in a co-authored article, I'm looking at how Taiwan responds to capitalist crises. So specifically looking at the 1997 Asian financial crisis, as well as the 2008 Great Financial Crisis. So thinking about reactions to global capitalism. And I think Taiwan provides a really interesting case because Taiwan doesn't react like other countries does because other countries do, because Taiwan's not a member of the international system. So for example, it doesn't have access to IMF loans as a lender of last resort. As a result, we see a very different kind of political policy with regards to how Taiwan deals with capitalist crises. The other project I'm thinking of is more of a kind of popular audience project. I think I want to explore the consequences of Taiwan's exclusion from the international system for the Western liberal project. So we often talk about Western kind of liberal international order, and often China is brought into this as kind of a challenge to that. But I actually think that Taiwan is a country that is liberal and democratic, but excluded from the system, actually poses a greater contradiction for the system. And so I would explore things like sovereignty rights movements of Taiwanese indigenous peoples, who we talk about how indigenous peoples predated nation states and should have their sovereignty recognized. But the sovereignty of Taiwanese indigenous peoples are doubly denied as indigenous peoples and denied as non-citizens of the world. They are not a part of a recognized state, which is a double denial of some ways and poses so many different kinds of contradictions and challenges and ironies to what we consider to be a Western liberal order.
Oh, two fantastic sounding projects. So we'll look forward to hearing more from you. Perhaps we can connect again when either one of those has been published.
I'd be happy to once it gets to more solid state.
We'll be patient. And actually, I'm sure you've got a lot on your plate as University of Washington. You're about to begin the Taiwan Studies track of the master program that you've got, right?
So, yeah, I'm really excited to have that. If I could put in a pitch for it, we do have a Taiwan track of our new East Asia MA program. We are recruiting students for this, so our next application cycle is going to open up this fall. You can check out our website to see what that looks like. Feel free to reach out to me as well if you're interested in applying for the program. I'd be happy to tell you more about the program. We're really eager as well to get students from Taiwan because there's some social media discussion about when our program launched. Contrary to that kind of social media buzz, we actually have just, I think this past cycle, we did not have any applicants from Taiwan. So contrary to what you might expect, we hope to get more.
As a Taiwan Studies graduate myself, I highly recommend anyone who's thinking of doing Taiwan Studies, and particularly if you're in the US, and University of Washington is the place to go. Well, thank you very much, James. And we'll keep in touch and we'll look forward to more conversations in the future.
Thank you so much for having me.
So that was Professor James Ling from the University of Washington. Thanks very much for listening. Don't forget that you can sign up to our bi-monthly Taiwan Studies newsletter from NTNU in the show notes. But until next time, I hope you have a good month. We'll be back soon.